Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Georgina and Lindsay Ratcliffe talking about cloves dyeing in the Tudor period.
Hello everyone. Right, to begin with, this is obviously a very brief overview of, I'd say, from sheep to cloth. So we'll talk about the dyeing aspect as well, sort of all the natural dyes that you used to get as well. So if I pass over to Lindsay, she'll start with the wool from the sheep.
Right, it doesn't always have to be sheep, of course, but in this instance I do have, just to show you, a fleece, or a little bit of a fleece. This, those of you who know the countryside and everything else might recognise as part of a Jacob. Jacob is one of the nicest ones to spin. It's nice, it's reasonably coarse, but it spins up quite well. So once you've got your cloth, your fleece like that, this is all still a bit nasty from the sheep itself, you get it washed it four times. The best way to wash it is you have four buckets of water, all with the same temperature to start with. You wash it in the first bucket and leave it in there for 5 minutes. So don't be too precious about what it's actually washed with. I use pumpy hand stuff. Smells nice. And then you take it out and you take it in the garden in a linen cloth and you spin it around your head like a mad thing to get the water out. Then you put it in the next bucket, which by that time has cooled down a bit. And by that time you can then, the wool will be the same sort of temperature. So by that way you don't shock it into putting it into too cold water or too hot water. It attains the same temperature and won't felt, it won't go nasty. So that is how to deal with that little lot. When you've got that, you then take lumps off like this and you run it through the cards by stroking it like this. And this gets all the fibres going all the same way. Otherwise you end up in a terrible mess. It just ends up as a load of cobweb. So you can just get it so that it all comes out nice and the same way. By doing that, I'll finish that later, you get these lovely rolls of soft cloth. That's not so good. These ones, which are then much easier to spin. Now this one that you can see is a Jacob. I've got bits of grey, I've got bits of white and bits of brown in it. I've got an old farm book from about 1642 where the farmer says, always ensure you have a couple of black sheep in your flock because that way you always have grey wool for your hose. So that's the way it all spins up like that. When it goes through there, I shall do that while she's chatting. It goes onto the bobbin once you've wound it like that. You then get two bobbins worth and you ply those together and you get that. So that is a skein of Jacob I did a couple of weeks ago. When it gets to this stage, you just give it another quick rinse just to get the last bits off, to get the last bits of straw. There's still straw in this and all sorts of horrible things. And then it's ready for dyeing, or if you've got just plain white, of course, it's much better. But this will knit up into lovely grey socks. So really there's not much more I can say. The wheel was used from about this period, about Tudor times, much more commonly. Before that, it had been a drop spindle. I will not show you how to do a drop spindling. I am hopeless. I end up with really big, thick wool. But if you can get it right, it's, you know, you spindle it, you pull the wool out like you would with an ordinary spinning wheel. And you just twist it and you get the right ply on it that way. But as I said, to be honest, my drop spindling is not of the best. So, but that's the way it would have been used. And I can show you on this, you can see this later. It's what women did, multitasking. You can see she's on a donkey, she's on her way to market, she's got a bag, she's got a baby at her breast, she's got spinning wheels, she's got a disc, she's got everything there. Woman does everything. So, but this is quite an interesting book as a history of, and it shows the drop spindles through the ages with the distaff and everything else, even back down to Egyptian times, of course, with their linen. This one is a wool wheel because the flax wheel, which is also used, is usually a bigger wheel called a great wheel, and it has a spike, which is the one Sleeping Beauty pricked her finger on, because it's a vegetable, you've got to, instead of just being nice and soft where you can just push it onto a piece of wood, the flax is a vegetable and you've just got to really jam it on like hay onto a distaff, and it's got a big spike on it. That is Sleeping Beauty's. It wasn't a wool wheel, it was a flax wheel. So I can, as I said, I shall carry on with this little lot. You can carry on with talking about the dyeing, mm-hmm. and I'll just keep myself occupied.
There's one thing as well to mention with the Tudor times. They used thistle heads as your carding. True. We had someone come up to us at an event once and went, "Ah, il cardo," and he was Italian, and that's what the thistle heads are called, is il cardo, which is where you get your carding from. So you get all that sort of linking in. It actually makes sense. And obviously with the English language, we sort of picked up bits from France, Italy, Germany, everything. We're sort of hybrid, really. Right, moving on to the dye process. Obviously, you can dye it in a multitude of ways. You can dye it straight as the fleece, you can dye it as the yarn, or you can dye it as the cloth. You've got a multitude of colours. So with this colour here, we've got, this is a logwood. So it's a type of bark which was coming in sort of late Tudor. It was coming in. It's very, very rich. But it's quite a susceptible one. You can change the colours on it quite easily just by changing the type of water you've got. From when I did a dyeing day down in Corfe Castle, it came out orange. When I went up to Lincoln, it came out pink. And so just by changing whether it's a soft water or a hard water area, it can manipulate the colour quite drastically. And it's like with the sort of the dye process, I think you have sort of three main ways of dyeing. So you get the cold dye, the hot dye, and your fermentation process. So your cold dye, that's what you use for your wools and for your leather, so that you wouldn't actually end up making it go all felty or with your leather go brittle. And you'll normally mordant that before dyeing. So mordanting is fixing your colour, basically, and using a multitude of different items for that, which I'll explain later. For your hot dyes, you would use that for your linens and your silks. At this time, we didn't have cotton, not in England anyway. So you would have literally only had wools, leather, linens and silks to dye with. For your fermentation process, that was mostly for your actual dye ingredient more than the actual material you're using. So the two main ones that we use for the fermentation process is woad and indigo. These dyes have to be starved of oxygen. And I have no idea how they work this out, but it's basically a massive urine bath. Urine's got to be a week old, sort of thing. So you've got all the ammonia coming out. Also, only male urine works. Female urine bleaches. So if you want your linens whiter, use your female urine. If you want to fix your colours, use male. And as you bring it out of the vat, so you leave it for like, I don't know, 10 days-ish, depending on the colour you want. As you bring it out, it'll actually start to change colour as the oxygen hits it. So I said, I've no idea how they found this out. It's actually quite surprising, really. But you can also tell with that sort of thing why dyers and tanners were on the outskirts of villages, and normally downwind as well. For the different colours you can get, so these are ones that I've done myself, apart from these ones, a friend did these for me, she does it professionally. But you can get a multitude of colours from everyday object or everyday vegetables, really. So you've got, cross won't use a pointer. This is beetroot, that's onion skin. These two pale ones are madder, which is a type of root. You've got your logwood there, and then those ones, I don't know if you can see them, is like your very pale sort of woad and things. I did that in water just to see what would happen, whether anything would happen, really. It's sort of all experimental archaeology, as we call it. It's a massive science project. before dyes sort of thing, everyone thought that, or before chemical dyes rather, everyone thought that everyone walked around in shades of sheep, really. You've got your black, your browns, your greys, your whites. The people who did do that were your monks or your friars. So you had your black friars, your grey friars and things like that, because colour was a vanity. So that's where it all sort of drops into place. Uh-huh, that's why. With the cheaper dyes, you had for the poorer members of society, you would have used more your sort of native plants. You've got your madder, which is a said type of root where you get your pinks and your oranges from. Your woad, which is a lovely blue. You've got goldenrod, which was actually, that wasn't native, I've discovered. It was actually came from the Americas, but it was actually quite cheap in comparison to a lot of the other dyes. You've also got weld, which is again another type of a weed. Your nettles and your onion skin. Nettles, by the way, if you're getting rid of them in your garden, they're fantastic items. So you can make rope from them, you can stew them, you can make a cordial out of them, and you can dye from them. The more expensive dyes you would have is your saffron, cochineal, indigo, and kermes, which is the origin word for crimson. It was also known that kermes scarlet was by far the most esteemed and most regal colour, apparently. This is your madder. So this is from, I think it's Culpeper's, because it was also Culpeper's herbal, because it was also used as a medicine. Madder is, donkey's years old, really. We had it back in the Vikings. It's been found in York. A lot of the material there has been excavated to bring up madder and woad, are the main two common colours coming up. And it was also used in, I said, medicines and things for yellow jaundice, the spleen, palsy, sciatica, and bruises. It's an all-round useful plant. But it's, you would mix it with different mordants, I said, for to get different colours. So you've got your different shades. So you've got sort of an alum would change the colour to a more pinky colour. It's a giant science product. It's like a chemistry project. It's depending on how alkaline and how acid your water is, depends on the colour you get. And with madder, like I said, you can get some fantastic oranges or you can get some scarlets as well. So if you go back to this colour, these six shades here are all madder. And you've got those two, so you've got a very bright red and a very pale pink, and that's just pure madder on its own without any mordants. It's just literally changing the water. You also have woad, which is probably our most native plant, and it was going on up until the 1930s when the last woad farm shut down in Lincolnshire. This, again, as I said, it needed the fermentation process, so it's quite a difficult one to get, but you can get some lovely shades of blues and greens and things. And the darker blue you wanted was the more you dyed it. So you sort of dyed it once, let it dry, dye it again, let it dry. So you got darker that way. The leaves were dried and crushed and composted with manure. And it was apparently the smell was so bad that Elizabeth I forbade the process of woad within 5 miles of any of her royal estates. It was an important dyeing agent in Europe and also England, especially during the medieval times and even during the Tudor times, because this is when we started getting the importation of indigo, which is a sister plant from India. And it was known as sort of around Europe, indigo was getting quite a nasty reputation because it rotted the clothes quicker because you needed more ammonia. And it was also somewhere around here, I've got a fantastic quote. In 1577, the German government officially prohibited the use of indigo, denouncing that as pernicious, deceitful, and corrosive substance, and the devil's dye. So I thought that's just a brilliant one. That sort of even went on sort of throughout the Tudor time. Sort of even though we had indigo available, we actually stuck with woad more because one, it was native, it didn't need as much ammonia, and it carried on till 1603, so it's a massive prohibition between 1594 and 1603. And they sort of called it a pernicious Indian drug. You also have goldenrod, which again, sort of this shows you sort of the different colours you can get. Sort of by dyeing it or mordanting it before. So this, you get a fantastic yellow if you mordant it before you dye it. You get a greeny yellow if you mordant it afterwards. And then you get a black if you mordant it before and afterwards. So you get a sort of a wide range of colours depending on how you use it. And even down to sort of like the pot you use sort of thing. Self-mordanting is if you use an iron pot, so you had your iron oxide, that mordanted it. You also had chalk that mortared it as well. So if you had, again, a hard water area, or your well was a chalk well, that was self-mordant as well. One of the things is... Oh, my mind just gone blank. Anyway, self-mordanting. Move on. These are sort of like the fantastic colours that you can get within Tudor England. So this is a colour chart from 1574. So, and I think my favourite one has to be goose turd green. It's just like, that just sums it up. none of this sort of fancy stuff from Dulux and all this sort of thing, sort of like saying, I don't know, midnight sun. No, goose turd green. So yeah, you can get a fantastic, and a lot of these as well can be changed into inks as well. One of the main colours we had was most difficult colours to have, or most expensive ones, was black. That one was had to be dyed so many times, because obviously the first time you dye it, you'll get grey, and then it will just gradually get darker the more you dye it. That used to be used with oak galls mostly, which again was typed to make ink, and because the amount of ammonia used on it, it literally rotted off your body. So if you saw someone wearing black, you knew they were rich, especially on a day-to-day trip. If they weren't going to court or anything like this, it's like they're showing off. It's like if you're around tomorrow, I'm getting dressed up as a Stuart lady and I'm all in black silk, so I'm sort of showing off because the amount of material I've got, and also it's silk and it's black, I'm just rubbing it in everyone's noses. But it was, that one was sort of like the definite sort of, you start bowing down to those people. And then we could move on. So it's like, not, you couldn't afford, or if you could afford any of the colours, you couldn't necessarily wear them, especially in Tudor times. You had the sumptuary laws. This was brought in by Edward III in the medieval times. And I think by this stage it was on like version 16, which... shows it was adapted by Henry VIII first and then Elizabeth II afterwards. But this basically is saying that anybody wearing ermine can only be royalty. And we had, it's like the top one is cloth of gold, silver, or no one can wear this apparel of cloth of gold, silver, satin, silk, or cloth mixed with gold or silver, nor any sables, except earls and all the superior degrees, the viscountess, barons in their doublets and sleeveless coats. So you sort of have all this sort of, it's like you can't wear pricking or prinking with gold or silver or silk unless you're a baron's son or a knight. Again, velvet was another one that was in the sumptuary laws as well, so you couldn't wear velvet of gowns in crimson, scarlet or blue unless you were a duke, marquess, earl or their children's. So with the sumptuary laws, you ended up you could judge the rank of that person and their social status just by what they're wearing. It's like you could, like the lower classes, literally, I don't even think they could wear rabbit skin. It's sort of like when you're sort of a merchant, then you get sort of upgraded to rabbit skin and things like this. So it even went down to sort of your money sort of thing. So maybe if you earned, you're a farmer and you earned £10 a year, you could then finally wear, or servants, shepherds, common labourers, servants, or to artificers, living outside any city or borough, all farmers worth less than £10 a year shall not wear cloth costing more than 2 shillings a broad yard, or hose worth more than 10 pence a yard. And the punishment for disobedience was imprisonment in the stocks for 3 days. So it just sort of like went to that extreme. And this sort of came into sort of, I think it started filtering out within the sort of Stuart time, really. And I think that's roughly it.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.